Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, brought to you today by Sanebox. Go to sanebox.com/martini to get $25 in extra credit on top of the two-week free trial of Sanebox. Sanebox will clean up your inbox and bring it closer to inbox zero. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, we have bad, we have crazy martinis for conservatives today. Jim, let's start with the good. The balance of power in the U.S. Senate will be one of the things we'll be watching very, very closely on election night. We have a couple of pieces of good news. You mentioned one in the Jolt today, and that's that the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee has pulled its advertising out of Florida. I don't know if it was in response specifically to the Rubio debate performance, but there's yet to be a poll that shows Rubio behind. There's one not too long ago that shows him up 8 points, and so the Democrats think that's largely a lost cause. Also, one of the National Review favorites, Pat Toomey, who has been behind in a lot of polls, although for the most part keeping it close, now finds himself up in the last two polls. At Quinnipiac, he's up 49-45, which is interesting because a lot of times that race has been in the 30s, so people starting to make up their mind there. And then in the Emerson poll, he's up 46-43. You like an incumbent to be at or above 50 at this point, but he's doing much better than he was. Still a lot of tough races out there. Indiana's not looking great. New Hampshire's not looking great. And obviously the best pickup opportunity in Nevada is looking a little bit sketchy right now, Jim. But when it comes to holding key Senate seats in key swing states where Trump might not be doing that great, Rubio and Toomey seem to be doing stronger.
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, I guess what's really the real good implication of what we're seeing in these polls is that New Hampshire has not looked good for Trump in a really long time, and Kelly Ayotte still looks like she's in it. I don't think Trump has led a poll in Pennsylvania. If he led it at any point in this election cycle, it was a long time ago. Florida's looking sketchy. I think Hillary has led the last couple ones there. And obviously Ohio, he's a little bit better. I think the last one I saw had them tied. Otherwise, there's a somewhat smaller lead for Trump. And Portman is running away with it. So we've got Republican senators who, in some cases, like Portman's, looks like he's going to be 15 points ahead of Trump, maybe even 20 points ahead. Just an unbelievable spread between the top of the ticket and the down ticket Republicans there. And similar effects in other states. Richard Burr in North Carolina, not the lock you'd like to see, but still running fairly close. And Hillary's had a pretty good lead in North Carolina there. So, I mean, all in all, the Republican Senate candidates are holding their own, or, you know, some might say just hanging on by their fingernails in a lot of states where they're getting absolutely no help from the top of the ticket. So, you know, we take the good news where we can get it, and there's I think the fact that the Democrats have pretty much given up on Ohio. If you told me a year ago, Greg, that the Democrats were going to give up on the Ohio and Florida Senate races, man, I think we'd be on easy street.
Easy street, maybe not so much, but in those races, it's definitely looking better and better. The larger picture, still unclear, but good to have those looking to be headed in the right direction. All right, on to the bad martini. And just earlier this week, we quoted the story from the Wall Street Journal, where a bunch of different states are seeing premiums in the individual market go up this year more than 30%, a bunch more than 20%. New Mexico, the largest carrier, is getting back in, but it's almost a doubling of the premiums. Well, yesterday, in advance of open enrollment, President Obama was in Florida, and he's got this amazing narrative of Obamacare that would be fantastic if any of it were true. He's going out there talking about how everybody's paying less money, how everybody's got fantastic health care now. Let's go through some of these clips, as painful as it may be, and try to add some sanity and facts to the story. Here he talks about why Republicans really don't like Obamacare. It has nothing to do with the actual policy. It's all about him.
So what's the problem? Why is there still such a fuss? Well, part of the problem is the fact that a Democratic president named Barack Obama passed the law. And that's just the truth. I mean, I worked really, really hard to engage Republicans.
So apparently we're partisan and racist by that comment, Jim. And no, he didn't actually engage Republicans. I believe the term was elections have consequences and I won. Then he got on to the actual details. This is for folks who get their health coverage through their employer but are seeing changes that they don't like.
Now, some people may say, well, I've seen my co-pays go up or my networks have changed. But these are decisions that are made by your employers. It's not because of Obamacare. They're not determined by the Affordable Care Act.
No, not at all. Employers aren't making any changes based on the Affordable Care Act. Then for those in the individual market, if you don't like the fact that your premiums are skyrocketing, also not his fault.
Although the marketplaces are working well in most of the states, there are some states where there's still not enough competition between insurers. So if you only have one insurer, they may decide we're going to jack up rates because we can, because nobody else is offering a better price. In those states where the governor or legislature is hostile to the ACA, it makes it harder to enroll people because the state is not actively participating in outreach.
Apparently the website doesn't work as well in those states, Jim. And then also the fact that these health insurance companies have to jack up premiums or else they'll go bankrupt. Here's the president's list of solutions to the problems for those in the individual market.
Here's what we can do instead to actually make the Affordable Care Act work even better than it's working right now. And I've already mentioned one. Florida and every state should expand Medicaid. Since overall health care costs have turned out to be significantly lower than everyone expected since we passed Obamacare, since that's saved the federal government billions of dollars, we should use some of that money, some of those savings, to now provide more tax credits for more middle-income families, for more young adults, to help them buy insurance. The third thing we should do is add what's called a public plan fallback.
So the answer is government, government, and more government. And then he made an odd analogy, Jim, to how he approaches tweaking the health care law and how Republicans approach it.
When one of these companies comes out with a new smartphone, then it has a few bugs. What do? They fix it. They upgrade it. Unless it catches fire, then they just then they pull it off the market. But you don't go back to using a rotary phone.
Jim, we've got our new punchline. Obamacare is the Galaxy 7 of healthcare plans.
As Marv Albert would say, it's on fire. en fuego, as they used to say in SportsCenter. You look back on the Three Martini podcast this year, Greg. We've done a lot of bashing of Hillary. We've done bashing of Trump. We've done a lot of bashing of people. I almost feel like we let Obama off a little bit too much this year. His approval rating is inching up, I suspect, in large part because he's out of the news cycle. He's on his way out. And then by all comparison, in a year that's been very coarse, Obama himself is not really kind of a very vulgar personality. But I think this speech illustrates a lot of the reasons I will think of him as a bad president, and you could even argue a failed president. Look, you can't argue that Republicans messed up Obamacare. They had no say in it. None of them voted for it. None of them had any tweaking in it or anything like that. None of them got to put in any amendments they wanted. As Nancy Pelosi told us, we have to pass the bill in order for you to see what's in it. This was their baby. This was their project, and they made all kinds of promises about it that have turned out to not be true. And here you have Obama talking about it, and he acts like, one, that all, as you've noted, all of the opposition was partisan, all the opposition was racist, and he completely ignores all the people who were saying, this isn't going to work, and you're not going to be able to keep these promises. I've noticed that point in there where he says, we just need more tax credits. You know, I would much rather spend less out of my pocket, Greg, that have to apply to the government to get some potential tax credit that they'll decide whether I deserve it or not, and then maybe give me a rebate on my taxes a year from now. But, to me, that's extremely inefficient. It's basically the government deciding, maybe we'll give you some money back because we've made this so expensive. Maybe we won't. We're going to make the rules. We're going to decide whether you deserve it or not. To me, it's much simpler. If you want something to be cheaper, the easiest thing is instead of giving people a rebate, 6 months down the road or a year down the road, give them the money then. In other words, try to make the price cheaper. How do you make the price cheaper? Competition. From the very beginning, Republicans have been saying it's time to let insurance companies sell across state lines. There are way too many state regulations. I'm fairly certain that, Greg, from one of my articles I wrote about this a while ago, There are states that require coverage of acupuncture. There are states that require hair transplant surgery to be covered. Every state has their own little regulations, their own little rules. So I think it's part of the problem, how every state decides, well, we're going to make health insurance companies cover procedure X because we like procedure X, or procedure X is popular, or we think people should have this covered, without realizing how once you require the insurance company to cover it, premiums go up for everybody else. Obama very blithely kind of hand waves away the giant premiums that have gone up for lots of people. He kind of blames it on monopolies without recognizing the possibility, hey, maybe you've set up a circumstance where only one insurance company is able to function under these regulations. As far as he's concerned, it's just the – what do you think? The employers just got mean all of a sudden? That they all of a sudden they're mean and nasty, but they weren't before? No. The rules changed. The law changed. The regulations changed. And as a result of that, a lot of companies are asking people to pay higher premiums, pay higher co-pays, and have higher deductibles. And I think a lot of people have pointed out, if you have like a $5,000 deductible, you don't really have health insurance. You only have you have basically the equivalent of catastrophic care. If you get hit by a bus and are in traction for a year, then you're covered. Short of that, you're in deep trouble. So a thoroughly just dishonest and I think just harmful to public discourse performance from the president. And I think he does real harm to the country when he talks about this and kind of hand waves away the legitimate criticisms of Obamacare by implying it's all just partisanship and racism.
Absolutely right. And this constant shtick that he's had ever since he started about he's the only one not playing politics. Everybody else is just in it to score political points, and he's the only one who's really interested in solving problems. It's tired. It's completely untrue. And the fact that 50%+ still buy it is perhaps one of the most depressing aspects of this year. All right, let's get a little happier here. Let's clean up your inbox. How many emails do you have? 100, 1,000, 10,000, 20,000, 50,000? If your email is anything like mine used to be and Jim's, the answer was too many. But even though I knew I wanted to do something about it, I didn't know how. I knew I'd miss something important if I just deleted them all, but there were too many emails to go through one at a time. Then we got together with Sanebox, and they let us try out Sanebox, and we learned the secret to reaching inbox zero and taking back the sanity of your email.
The product is Sanebox. Greg and I cannot recommend this enough. Sanebox sorts through your email and moves all of your trivial stuff into a different folder, so the only messages left in your inbox are the ones you actually want to see. Aside from removing all the junk so you can focus on the messages that matter, there's this thing called the black hole. If you move an email into that folder, you will never hear from that sender again. It's great for spam. It's great for annoying people, Uncle Leo, who won't stop harassing you, hate mail, lunatics, anybody you're counting with you'd never want to see again. This is the way you do it through email. It is so rewarding. Greg and I both use Sanebox, and we've worked out a great deal for our listeners.
Visit Sanebox.com/martini today, and they'll throw in an extra $25 on top of the normal two-week free trial. You don't have to enter your credit card information unless you ultimately decide to buy, so there's really nothing to lose except an opportunity to bring back some sanity to your inbox. Check it out today and let us know if you love all these different features, including the black hole and reaching inbox zero as much as we do. Sanebox.com/martini, Sanebox.com/martini. Jim, on to the crazy martini now, and it was just Thursday. We were talking about how we'd never have to see Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton on the same stage again. I knew ultimately we'd probably be wrong about that, but I didn't realize it was the very next day that they were going to run into each other at the Al Smith dinner in New York. It's probably every year, but every 4 years it gets a lot of attention because they invite the major party nominees just prior to the election. It's quasi-roast, quasi-self-deprecation. And usually the candidates do a fairly decent job. This year, while some jokes went over well, others didn't on both sides. Let's start with Hillary.
You know, I've had the privilege of being at the Al Smith dinners in years past, and I always enjoy it. But remember, if you're not happy with the way it comes out, it must be rigged. And it's always a special treat for me to be back in New York. A city that I love and which I think truly embodies the best of America. You know, don't you think? People look at the Statue of Liberty and they see a proud symbol of our history as a nation of immigrants, a beacon of hope for people around the world, Donald looks at the Statue of Liberty and sees a 4. Maybe a 5 if she loses the torch and tablet and changes her hair.
Jim, there was a little bit of laughter there, but usually at the Al Smith dinner, it's pretty uproarious laughter. Trump had some good lines. Hillary had some lines that were well-received as well. But towards the end, Trump got very political, and it didn't go over well.
We've learned so much from WikiLeaks. For example, Hillary believes that it's vital to deceive the people by having one public policy and a totally different policy in private. That's okay. I don't know who they're angry at, Hillary. You're right. For example, here she is tonight in public pretending not to hate Catholics. Everyone knows, of course, Hillary's belief that it takes a village, which only makes sense, after all, in places like Haiti, where she's taken a number of them.
So there you go, Jim. Hillary and Trump, we just wish they would go away, and they can't even do a relatively lighthearted event well.
Yeah, for those who don't know, the Smith Dinner is supports Catholic charities in the New York area. It's a long tradition going back, I believe, to like the 1930s or so. Here's the thing. If you laugh at yourself, everyone else can laugh with you. You kind of give the permission. You give the audience permission. And I think jokes, when you make fun of yourself, and Greg, you and I do this pretty frequently, when it comes to mocking ourselves, we have a lot of material to work with. And you know, when you do that, I think that comes from a place of genuine confidence, right? If you're really insecure about something, you don't joke about it, right? You don't want to bring it up. You don't want anybody to notice it or anything like that. If you're comfortable in your own skin and who you are, you don't have to pretend to be good at everything. And you can say, people joke about, oh, how bad my golf game is. Or, oh, you know, my weight is not what I want it to be. So when Jim Garrity sits around the house, he really sits around the house, you know, kind of, you know, these old easy jokes. Neither Trump nor Hillary really stuck with that. They felt the need to put some jabs at the other side. And it's not completely unprecedented at the Al Smith Dinner to do that, but I think you can just see from that audience reaction that both of them, you know, here's the thing, I think deep down, despite that long ago wedding invitation, I think right now Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton really hate each other. And some people may argue whether or not they think that's justified. I think it was really unfortunate timing for the Al Smith Dinner to come after the third debate. I think it really, you know, I think last night was a good example of the tradition of the Al Smith dinner can't work in a political culture that is the way it is. The country is just too angry. It is just too bitter. That no one can really, one, is that comfortable making fun of themselves anymore. I mean, Hillary had a couple of good lines. She said something like, you know, I've been the life of the party at every party I've ever gone to in my life, all three of them. Trump had said something like, I always feel like I'm getting treated unfairly by the media. Michelle Obama gives a speech and everybody applauds her. Melania can give the exact same speech and everybody's up in arms about it, making fun of Melania's plagiarism from her convention speech. So, you know, a little bit of that. But I think ultimately, deep down, these are two very insecure candidates who basically aren't comfortable making fun of themselves, who basically don't like that idea and who are really, you know, still kind of seething about the other. I think it came out last night, and I think most people in the audience felt like that's not really what the evening's supposed to be about. You know, maybe the Al Smith dinner needs to be at a different time of the election, a different time of year, because I think last night was not what the organizers wanted. And I think it's kind of a reflection of the year that we really can't put aside our differences and have some fun and laugh at ourselves and support good charities without the ugly sentiments of this election starting to burst through there.
I think you're exactly right about the timing of it. I felt it was awkward in previous cycles, and it feels especially awkward in this cycle. It's also weird the night after a debate when you spent the whole time talking about how you're the champion of the little guy, and then you're in formal wear rubbing elbows with the billionaires of New York City. So it's just an odd combination and an odd timing. So once again, great job, Hillary and Trump. So, Jim, time for the weekend. Have a good one.
Can't wait, Greg. I'll see you on Monday.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And remember to go to sanebox.com/martini. That way you'll get an extra $25 credit on top of your two-week free trial to get your sanity back to your inbox, sanebox.com/martini. Join us again on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.